The world is not yet on track to avoid dangerous, irreversible climate change. But while the gravity of the task may appear daunting, there are plenty of positive signs that we can accelerate action to create thriving, sustainable societies. The interest is obvious. The ideas abound. The innovations exist or are currently being developed. And investments are increasing. So how do we harness this at scale in order to drive climate action? How can we expedite our path towards positive tipping points across key sectors of the economy? Welcome to Ahead of the Curve. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about creating positive impact. Throughout this series, produced in collaboration between The Conduit and Systemic, we'll bring to your attention some of the people, policies, organizations, and innovations that are creating positive tipping points we need for a net zero society. Our conversations with leading experts will reveal how climate action is already transforming economies, and they'll offer actionable insights into how we can move further faster to meet the objectives of the Paris Agreement. This episode is recorded at the Conduit Studio at COP26, and this series is produced in collaboration with Systemic, a B Corp dedicated to making economic systems regenerative and sustainable.
Well, hello everybody. I'm here with Anne Simpson, Managing Investment Director at CalPERS, the huge California pension fund. Catherine Sidorka, partner, sustainable finance at Systemic, and been deep into blended finance and various other ways of getting finance to move, not least to emerging markets, which we're going to come to for sure in our conversation. But our conversation is largely focused on how finance is, or possibly isn't, moving us towards tipping points in the transformation in our economy that we need in order to deal with climate change. Some of the themes we're going to explore, what might be those tipping points, what's going to make the difference, what's changed, what may be changing because of COP and some of the big announcements which have been made, how we're going to take account of those huge numbers that have been announced during the course of the week, but think hard about implementation, what else needs to change to make that money flow, and then maybe pick up on some various themes that I know you know about. What kind of instruments do you think perhaps hold out the best hope for moving that money in a new direction? So, Kat, why don't we start with you, and you know, just survey for us what's happening at the moment at this event, which gives you some feeling that perhaps we might be heading towards some kind of tipping point, maybe because of all these announcements on finance.
Thank you, James. And I just have to say it's such a pleasure to be here with you and also with Anne, my personal hero for a very long time, given your leadership in this agenda. And maybe that's in terms of tipping points where I could start, James, because this is being dubbed the finance COP. Who's showing up at this COP really matters. We've got challenges around inclusion here, but we have seen in huge force the financial institutions, from pension funds to private equity to asset managers to, you know, the VC guys trying to do new tech. Everyone's here from the financial community, and that starts to show me that we get the why, and now we need to talk about the how. I do need to remind us, though, that since Paris, we've still had $3.8 trillion go into fossil fuels. In 2019 alone, we had $2.6 trillion go into sectors that are major drivers of biodiversity destruction. So that's roughly the size of the GDP of Canada. There's a lot of money still going into the bad stuff, into these dirty assets. I've got cause for hope, though, when we talk about tipping points. If I think about issuance of bonds this year, yes, and loans, coal, oil and gas bonds and loans were about $460 billion, and green bonds and loans were about $463 billion. So even split on fees, we're starting to see how this really makes sense, at least in the capital markets. And that gives us cause for I think, hope, but we're also seeing that tipping point. If we're half and half at the moment, suddenly, with the right people in the room at the finance COP, this really is a private sector-owned agenda now. They get the green, they get the why. It's how we do that.
And let me immediately turn to you to see how you interpret these big announcements that are being made. You're obviously very familiar with the sheer scale of them. I mean, you know, it's quite hard to hold 130 trillion in your head, but just to give me your perspective on all these big money announcements.
Oh, I think Kat said it beautifully. It's the how. And how do we hold finance accountable for these bold, brave, shiny new claims? So, back to my grandmother, one of her good bits of advice in life, fine words butter no parsnips. So if we're measuring progress by statements, it's all sorted. But the real thing now is, how do we make sure that these financial commitments are translated into action? And we don't really have that framework of accountability in the financial sector. So this issue of snake oil in finance is as old as the hills. The question of whether we're getting what is promised is a serious challenge. So for that reason, we know that the policymakers obviously want to draw the money in. And I think the numbers that you just cited show very well how the money is moving. The question is, there's still a gap between what's being said and what's being done.
Yeah.
So on the CalPERS side, we've got our own members who hold us to what we promise, because we're a pension fund where our members elect half the board, the taxpayers appoint the other half. We have our investment meetings in public.
Yes.
So Kat, you, James, any of the listeners or viewers to this discussion can watch the YouTube channel and see a CalPERS board meeting. You can ask a question, you can call out what the decisions are. Now, when we get situations, for example, like at DWS, where the head of sustainability is fired after she has attempted to correct some claims, allegedly, this is now triggering this question about, are we in the realm of snake oil in sustainability?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, I was thinking about this whole issue. I mean, people talk about greenwashing, but it's not just about the environment, it's the human capital side of it, like what's actually happening with the impact on people. And I was looking back at these early court cases in the United States when snake oil was being sold as the cure for everything. Mm. But the first court cases were about, there's not enough snake in the snake oil. You're not giving us the snake that you promised. So there were court cases made and won, and then about 30 years later, it's like, the snake oil doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
So even if you've got, so, and I think we're in a bit of that situation where we've accepted that the snake oil has got to have some snake in it, but does it actually work? Will it make people fall in love with you?
Yeah.
Will it make you, you know, cure your hair if it falls out, or, you know, your teeth do the same? So I think this is why the whole agenda around accounting and audit is so
metrics
important.
Metrics and performance standards and all those things.
Yeah, all of that, because we need this radical transparency. It's not just what you say, but what you do. And it's very hard to get at that in the financial sector. So all of these calls for the banking sector, the insurers, pension funds like ours, but the investment managers, and remember, it's not their money.
No.
They are investing other people's money. How we hold the financial intermediaries accountable is going to be a big part of how we get this done.
Mm.
Because, you know, the warm words won't do it.
No.
And James, you know who they won't do it for is the countries where this money is meant to flow. And we know it's got to be, you know, the lion's share, at least two-thirds, going into emerging markets, global south. That's where there are huge opportunities. If we think 17.3 trillion or something in green buildings in Asia, for example, the opportunities are big, important, and we should stop thinking about this as an aid agenda and one of investment. But it means we need the right people in the room.
It's an investment agenda with tremendous opportunity, but still with many barriers and high costs.
Mm.
And it's sometimes very difficult, either for an asset owner when thinking about how to allocate their capital, or an asset manager thinking about how they're going to get their returns, to get over sometimes a perception hurdle mm-hmm. that the risk is too high and it's therefore costly to deploy money into some of these critical situations in so-called emerging economies, in parts of the world where there's growth, mm-hmm. but where we need money to go into the built environment, into the power sector, into regenerative agriculture, into all sorts of ways. These are difficult things to resolve, and you've had a go at them, Catherine, I know, with various devices to get that cost of capital down. Give us some insight into how we might be able to do that.
Putting me on the spot, James, with a really hard question. And it's hard because, as you say, there are barriers. There are financial system barriers which make it difficult and risky, lack of data, lack of track record in some of these markets. The concept that I think you're referring to is blended finance, using public capital, development finance, even philanthropic capital to act as a pathfinder or a way of taking some risk, providing downside protection if you're going into maybe more nascent sectors like regenerative agriculture or more challenging markets, and particularly to accelerate energy transition or transition in other high carbon extractive sectors. It's a bit of a call to action, James, which you've allowed me, which is that all of the big public commitments, you know, we've just heard about how important it is on the private sector side that these are not just fine words, that there's the right integrity and standards to hold commitments to account, and that we really understand whether it's snake oil or whether it's not. That applies to the public and the development commitments. We need to see the $100 billion as a floor, not a ceiling, and we're scraping to get there. But we also need to use that money way smarter to do some of this deep de-risking, crowding in, and pathfinding.
Much better leverage than we've had in the past.
Exactly. And I always say it to you, James, so forgive me for being boring, but the development banks, the multilateral development banks, currently mobilize less than a dollar of private capital for every public dollar. We need those mobilization ratios to increase. We need them to target particularly sectors around natural capital, around just transition. This is a people and a planet agenda, and that money desperately needs, I think, to modernise and make it easier to engage with private investors who are searching for these new opportunities. It's not the end goal that everything's blended. It's a tool to help crowd in capital so that you've got new money in new markets.
Well, there may
well
be yields.
I'm just going to say, you said it so beautifully, Kat, but what I'm thinking about is we've already got blended money and it's a kind of coagulated, nasty, corrupt mess. Look at the subsidies that are given to fossil fuels, right? So you're saying, okay, well, the market can be very, very powerful. We can harness the people's savings, whether it's tax dollars or pension funds or other forms of saving. This is the common wealth. And the task here is how to harness it for the common good. That's really what the financial system is. That's the purpose of the financial system. But what's happening at the moment is hundreds of billions of dollars are propping up fossil fuels through subsidies, which are costing a huge amount of money. And what we're saying, if you just think about this from a pension fund like CalPERS, our point of view, we say markets are going to do the best that they can when they've got two things. One is information, and exactly as Kat said, we've got to have accounting and audit reflecting these three forms of capital which need to be managed as part of the Commonwealth. And just as you rightly said, Kat, you said people and planet, and I guess profit is in the air for three P's. We at CalPERS say it's financial capital, it's human capital and natural capital. And we have to hold boards of directors in the private sector accountable for the management of all three in a holistic way. So that means information. So all eyes, please, on the bean counters. The bean counters have never been more important to a social issue, because if we don't, we've just done some work looking at the 100 biggest greenhouse gas emitters through this initiative Climate Action 100+. Now think about this. CalPERS has got about 10,000 companies in our portfolio, but around 100 of them are responsible for 85% of the emissions. You say, aha, now let's focus there. However, working with a group called Carbon Tracker, we sort of pulled their accounts apart. So the fine words, ah, yes, all praise the Paris Agreement, this is marvellous, we're signed up. If you look at actually what's on the financials, you see that there is a complete disconnect between what's being presented in terms of the financials and what's being claimed in terms of climate. So information is the first thing the market needs, and that's lacking. So the global sustainability agenda on accounting and audit is fundamental, and it's not there at the moment. That's a job for the bean counters and their regulators. And the other thing we need to sort out is incentives. Now, at macro level, the obvious example is the fossil fuel subsidies. But then we also need to look and say, what are people in the financial system being rewarded for doing? So if you look at the oil sector, and we still see executives being rewarded for increasing proven reserves. So if that's your job, you say, oh, you had a nice big fat bonus for doing that. One of the things we're saying through Climate Action 100+ is the incentives we want on the policy side need to be reflected on the bonuses internally. So we have quite a big number of companies now have rewritten their bonus targets. I think BP is a good example. They've put 14,000 executives into a new performance plan where your performance is going to be measured on your ability to deliver on bringing emissions down. Now, that concentrates minds wonderfully. Now, we're not saying everybody is just motivated by money, but if throughout the OECD countries we've got this proliferation of bonus schemes, that is totally misaligned. We don't have pricing on externalities that are negative. We've got whopping great subsidies, and then we'll add one more little thing into it. Well, why is policy not being developed in the way that Kat is saying is necessary? Well, look at political lobbying. At share owner money belongs to pension funds like ours. So what you're now seeing is not just that we're calling on companies to make the commitments, those are the fine words. We want the action. We've built out a benchmark that measures progress, time-bound, short, medium, and long-term towards the net zero 2050 goal. We're not just looking at emissions, we're looking at CapEx. That's the alignment of the financial capital. We've just today launched a framework for the just transition, which is about the acknowledgement of the consultation with and the response to the needs of workers, vulnerable communities, the impact on Indigenous peoples and so forth. But we've also got political donations.
So you're going to track where your money goes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then where does that all lead you? Well, I would say Exhibit A, where does that lead you, is Exxon. So we as a community of owners of Exxon, we've been called upon to divest, to sell our shares, to walk away. Of course, all that means is we sell our shares to someone else. It doesn't really affect the company in any way or form. Removing directors from the board of Exxon through supporting Engine One's campaign and working closely with them and bringing three new directors onto the board, that's the sign of hope for me. Because if the current cohort of the great and the good isn't ready and willing to take the action, not the fine words, but, you know, butter the parsnips,
so this is interesting.
We need new leadership.
Yes, we, part of our program here has been to look at leadership. And we talked to our friend and colleague, Faustine, about that. And one of the things that we noted, probably pretty obvious, is that we don't have the right people at board level to make these decisions. The people who have risen to the top, particularly in some of those companies where the incentives have been very obviously there in order to maximize profit, but not deal with those other two capital requirements that you mentioned, it's unlikely that those people are going to have the same perception of risk, the same evaluation of opportunity that you would if you spent your life working on these complex climate problems.
And apologies to intervene on that point, it's also the diversity, equity and inclusion agenda. So what we have come to appreciate at CalPERS is we need boards that are independent. Everybody got that a long time ago. We need boards that are diverse and reflect the communities that the companies are serving. And three, they have to be competent. Yeah. So the idea of climate competent boards means we're suddenly looking at, for example, at Exxon, we say, wow, nobody on this board has ever worked in the energy industry. Mm. No surprise that management's strategy, or lack thereof, as we would say, hasn't been fully interrogated by the board. We hire and fire the board. The other thing I just want to add as a little footnote, in the United States, you do not have the legal right to hire and fire the board. Mm. You have to win that right.
Yeah.
And under Delaware law, under California state law, and under New Jersey law, where Exxon's incorporated, the proxy card, you know, your election ballot says, here we are, Mr. So-and-so, up for the vote. And you think, marvellous. Yes. You turn your proxy card over. Well, where's no? No, you can't vote no. You can. And it's very, it's rather sort of coy in its own way. You can withhold your vote. But of course, if you withhold your vote as your only alternative, whoever it is can just vote for themselves, or their mother will, out of love and devotion, and they'll be put back on the board. So what we've had to do at CalPERS with other big investors, before we can even get into this question of holding boards accountable, is be allowed to even replace them. So we couldn't have done this at Exxon if we hadn't several years ago won the right for what's quaintly called majority voting. There's an idea. And we used to tease, the corporate sector when we started doing this work a few years ago at CalPERS and say, how is it that the world's biggest capital market is run through a form of board elections which reflect a rather Soviet view of accountability?
Yes. Yes.
So when we're looking at these complex issues,
Soviet view and country club combined.
Yeah, in the biggest capital market in the world. So getting at these issues, their governance issues, in a way, the governance issues, the accountability has to be built, has to be won. Yeah. And then we can start having the dialogue about...
It's a very good angle, isn't it, Kat? Mm. Because it's diversity of thinking we need.
Yes.
But it's also accountability.
Yes.
In a form that grips the consciousness of a decision maker. Mm-hmm. Because quite a lot of the other accountability mechanisms are a bit too distant, aren't they? Mm. Whereas, you know, you're in a position of power.
I think losing your job concentrates minds wonderfully.
And there's a certain amount of... shaming that goes on in that process that can work. So I wonder whether we can make this connection between the sort of changed thinking that involves and the sort of different incentives and where you think opportunity might be for new directions in finance. I mean, where should we be thinking about where the new directions are, given these big commitments? Mm. Is there a particular point in the spectrum that you think these real emphasis to make money move to something else? Where, give us a sense of where the new thinking is for the direction. Let me go to Kat first.
Emerson, I love listening to Kat. She's brilliant.
Well, I mean, I'm firstly glad you brought up the leadership agenda again, because I started this saying it was a privilege to be on this podcast with you, and I think you've just heard leadership in action. Yeah. That's a lot of complexity to...
Teamwork in action.
Exactly. No, really, really a privilege to be on with you. There are a couple of things, James. Firstly, I think it is this issue of climate competence. You know, if you know and understand that you're exposed to risk, let's start with risk in the financial community, that helps focus the mind as well. You know, if it's risk of losing your job, but also your exposure to losing money. We are getting incredible tools to understand physical transition litigation risk. And the challenge we have now is to integrate it into investment decision making.
Exactly.
It's not enough to have, I think, transformative leadership coming from the top, and it's not enough to have, you know, the most excited new grads also grasping this green agenda. You've got to make it
embedded in the day-to-day practices of those institutions.
Exactly.
When you go to work, that's how you do things in order to get that outcome.
Exactly. And then it's incentives, of course, because if we require people to put their jobs on the line, actually, and to be courageous on this stuff, that I think people are really courageous in this space, but expecting, you know, every human being to kind of risk their job just to integrate a net zero or a green commitment, in whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a banker, I think we need to actually standardize and embed and integrate this into transaction documents, loan agreements, investment decision-making processes. So that's the unsexiest thing I've said today.
But completely correct.
But really, really
important. But necessary to the reproductive system.
Exactly.
Because that's how system change happens, right?
It's a pollination of ideas. Big vision,
leadership, certainly, but a series of intervention points.
Yeah.
With lots of levers to pull every day. So
exactly.
The system changes.
Yep. I'll punt that.
I've got a last one.
I just have to sneak it in. No, it's a good way to round off. Let's go for it.
Private markets.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening in the public markets, and I think Kat has just set out exactly what we need. We need the training, the incentives, the investment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
We need the regulators and the beneficiaries and the people who the money belongs to need to be able to have a line of sight into all of that. But we've tended to focus on the public markets.
Yes.
Now, if you look at the role of public markets, they're becoming less and less and less important. The private markets are booming, and public markets are relatively less important for kinds of reasons we talk all day about.
But
the result is
we
at CalPERS have just recently developed and launched a new ESG data convergence platform with a $4 trillion alliance, just to kick it off, of general partners and limited partners like ourselves, pension funds like APG, APB, CPPIB in Canada.
Yeah.
And we've chosen six areas which we think are fundamental to our fiduciary duty to create sustainable returns. And they include issues like, renewables, that's one piece you'd expect to see. Why does that matter? Because what's happening is not only does the divestment trend mean dirty assets are changing hands, which doesn't change the
assets. Often coming out of public companies into private.
Thank you.
There's a lot of that going on, isn't there?
There is indeed. Hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And then we've got a problem out of sight, out of mind.
Mm. Yep.
So we've got to get at private markets. So this new ESG data convergence platform is setting standards on emissions, the dirty assets still being tracked from cradle to grave, also on net job creation, on diversity, on health and safety, and a set of other measures as well. What that is enabling us to do, and in April 2022, we'll have the first reporting out of this, we're then going to be able to start correlating standards on financial capital with human and natural capital.
Mm.
And it's very interesting. I was just talking to my colleague who's leading this work, Julia Jaskolska, and she's had a first look at the early data stream that's coming in from this work. We're only a couple of months into it, but the correlation between diversity and financial performance is already evident, which is very encouraging.
Yeah.
But you need the numbers.
So, look, we have to bring this great conversation to a conclusion, sadly. It's a bit of a cliche that we have plenty of capital in the world. It's certainly accumulating. There's a lot of question marks as to where it should go or how rapidly it should go. But our main task is to make it flow towards the solutions to climate change and away from further risk. And we've had some ideas here about how that might happen. Some of it is focused on the people making the decisions. Some of it's focused on the public policymakers. Some of it's focused on the sheer scale of the opportunity in markets that perhaps haven't been adequately addressed. But the challenge which we must rise to is to take these big, big commitments, the massive numbers on finance, mobilize it, move it to where it's needed, move it sensibly, not in a helter-skelter way, but get on with getting this capital deployed, so that we can start regenerating our natural systems and finding true value in them and making sure that we've got enough resources to do this transition to a net zero economy and do it in time.
Mm.
So thank you very much, Kat
and
Anne.
Lovely to talk to you.
Good to be with you. And
James, I'll have the final word, which I always love in a conduit conversation: get more women on boards. That's how we tackle everything that James just said.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Ahead of the Curve, produced in partnership with Systemic, who are addressing the world's biggest challenges with new solutions for the benefit of business, society, and the planet. Find out more about Systemic at systemic.earth. You can connect with The Conduit and our community of changemakers by visiting theconduit.com. This podcast series is available on The Conduit's website and on all major podcast platforms on the Conduit Conversations channel.